what's unique about honeybees and what makes them so excellent for agricultural pollination is when a scout gives the information to a bunch of workers, they go out and they will only go after that one flower source.
This is The Butterfly Effect, a podcast that shows the big impact a small action can do. Tali Orad is talking to those special people that make a difference with nature and trees.
Welcome everyone to The Butterfly Effect. My name is Tali Orad. I'm your host and your butterfly here. My special guest today is Ben Cooper. Ben is an agriculture specialist, recently retired from Maryland Department of Agriculture after 32 years. Ben is now a beekeeper. He teaches beginners classes at the local college. He is the president of the local beekeeping association, life member of both Maryland and Pennsylvania State Beekeepers Associations, and a mentor to many new people getting into the hobby. Welcome, Ben, to The Butterfly Effect.
Thanks for having me, Tali.
Let's start with the work you did as an agriculture specialist. Maybe start by explaining what it is, that role, and what were your responsibilities?
I worked for Maryland Department of Agriculture out of a county, local county soil conservation office. I kind of say it was one of the best jobs to have because I got paid to go around and walk on people's farms and properties, and I got to help them and assist them, sometimes just providing some production-oriented stuff. But mostly my key was to focus in on conserving water and protecting water from sediment and pollution and basically keeping soil where it belongs and keeping water clean.
And what do you mean by that?
For example, if there was a farm that I would visit and the animals, mostly cattle, had full access to a stream, mm-hmm. then providing state-funded cost share for the farmer to fence those animals out of the stream or collect the water off of a barn roof instead of running through a barnyard. It would be piped away and discharged into a local stream so it's clean. And then any of the steep hills that they would be plowing or working for planting crops, planting on the cross slope or contour, planting a variety of crops rather than always plowing it up so that you put some sod in there to keep the soil stable and keep the water clean.
What does it matter if the livestock get close to the water? I mean, that's natural drinking for them too.
It's natural drinking for them, but a lot of people will collect the water in the area that I worked with, went into the Potomac, which is also the water that people in Washington, D.C. drink. Mm-hmm. Too much nitrogen, too much pollutants into the free-flowing water can be detrimental to the fish species. It changes the aquatic species in the streams itself, and you lose things like trout and some of the other good indicator species that would naturally be there.
Did you also suggested more tree planting for all the farms you worked with?
So instead of just planting a fence line alongside of a stream, actually through state and federal funding, paying farmers to plant trees alongside at least 35 feet on each side of the stream so that it provides shade for the water, but also a root mass to keep mm-hmm. soil and keep the bank stabilized. So yeah, I got to work with tree planting crews to establish quite a few riparian buffers.
And I'm assuming those tree forest buffers were native trees that support the biodiversity and the ecosystem and also brought in different animals that probably would not be there right. otherwise, right?
Right. We looked to, most of the time, we looked to providing some kind of food production, let's say nuts or native fruit for wildlife that would be beneficial to that riparian forest buffer, or that corridor as well. Mm-hmm. And the state of Maryland allowed us to use 10% non-native, but they could not be invasive. So if you wanted to put in some fruit-bearing trees that were not native, but still beneficial, they were allowed to put in 10%. But most of the time it was native, and it was trees that were raised and propagated by Maryland Forestry Department in their nursery. So they would collect seeds in different areas of Maryland. Maryland's unique because they call it Little America. You have everything from cold weather and 200 inches of precipitation in mm-hmm. the western side, and then you have everything from the ocean and really dry, longer seasons in the eastern side of Maryland. So where I worked was the most mountainous area, and so it created challenges, but in my opinion, it was the best place to work and live and be able to. It's kind of like telling somebody that has mostly trees on their property to plant trees alongside the stream. Kind of like that idea of selling ice cubes to the Eskimos.
Right, right.
But whenever you put some money to the mix and say, hey, let the federal government pay you rent for that ground for 15 years. And then after 15 years, the trees are pretty well established. Each site was unique. So we would pick out, because the soils are unique, and we would pick out trees that would fit that site and fit the landowner's desire mm-hmm. too, whether it would be wood production years down the road, or if it would be for wildlife production.
Yeah, so it's a huge incentive for them. By the way, I feel like the latest trends in public opinion is shifting these days in terms of agriculture. And I mean, for example, I see people eating less meat, talk about the disadvantage of using vast pastures land over, honestly, forest. Is there anything you feel as agriculture expert you can bring to the table to say, well, it's not that bad, we can find the middle ground?
I think people are moving more towards, and hopefully more to, sustainable agriculture mm-hmm. rather than big commercial agriculture where you're tilling up the ground and you constantly have to put commercial fertilizers into the ground to get things to grow. 100 years ago, people didn't worry about their pasture. They managed their crop fields. And so as the transition moved and shifted towards more pasture management, animals could be rotated and grasses could be more permanent rather than tilling up the ground and putting their own nitrogen back into the ground by use of legumes. And that could be trees, plant species, or shrubs, letting nature basically sustain the nutrient levels rather than always plowing it up and planting, and the cost of chemical fertilizers and right. fuel to run multiple times over top of the same piece of property. It compacted the soil, so you had to do more to loosen it up to plant. And so it was kind of like you're always defeating yourself. And so the shift in the area that I worked with, and especially pasture management, is to get good quality pastures. That would mean the good quality food in hay and forages that are stored up.
And you recently retired from being the agriculture expert. I'm assuming it will always stay with you.
But... yes, I grew up on a multi-species farm in western Pennsylvania. So graduated, went to Penn State, knew I wanted to work in agriculture because it's in my blood.
And now you're into beekeeping. What made you start?
Actually, I started when I was 14 years old as a 4-H project. And so I've been involved with beekeeping for at least half the amount of years I've been alive. I found it fascinating. Nobody else was doing beekeeping as a 4-H project. And I'm that person that does the unique thing and goes out the road less traveled, so to speak.
By the way, 4-H programs are grounded in the belief that kids learn by doing. Kids and teens complete hands-on projects in areas like science, health, agriculture, and of course, in our case, bees. Ben, what have you learned from working as a beekeeper?
Honeybees have been the most studied insect of all time. Mm-hmm. And they're still scratching the surface, realizing that they have unique ways to communicate. They have unique abilities, and research is still going on to figure out how these single insects work as a colony, as a group, for the common good.
And what have you learned?
I'm learning more about how to read and communicate, how the bees will communicate with me with what's going on in their hive, not only how they communicate with each other or the next hive that's right next door to them and what they can and can't do. I learn by what species that they are attracted to. And so I can plant or encourage on my property flowers and things that are beneficial to them. People are worried that the bees are dying off. Yeah, they're dying because of mites, that small little spider insect arachnid that affects them. But we're learning how to counteract. Hopefully those that are aggressive managers are learning how to control and eliminate that.
So there are a few things we can learn from the bees. They are, in a way, climate indicators. They help us with the environment and the ecosystem. I want to start maybe with the climate change and ask you, how are bees climate indicators? What role do they play in measuring climate change?
Yeah, they're one of the indicator species that are easily measured to determine what's going on. For example, the Goddard Space Center had carried on for quite a few years research that one of the oceanographers was actually a beekeeper as a sideline on his own, but started following that the bees are bringing in, as if you can imagine up in where you are, Tally, in New York, your cold winters. And as soon as the first flowers, the floral blooms start happening, the bees will start bringing in pollen. Mm-hmm. They need that protein early on in the years. And so what Wayne Isaias from the Goddard Space Center started doing was actually putting a simple scale, like an old farm scale that you would weigh sacks of grain or feed. He put that on underneath hives and started weighing them in the morning and in the evening. Mm-hmm. And so you have a baseline to start off the day. And if it was warm enough, 45 degrees or warmer, the bees would go out and fly. If there was a floral source there to collect nectar or pollen, they would bring that back. And at the end of the day, that hive would be heavier. Or if there was nothing, it would be lighter because they are actually consuming their resources. Or it would stay the same. They're bringing in a little bit, but they're also using those resources. So there's now 20 different countries in the world that use what's called scale hives, weighing the bees. But what it does is tell you that what time of year the floral source is being brought in by the bees. Mm-hmm. Over several decades of gathering information, those hives that have these scales on them have been able to record that just about every year, half a day earlier, over two decades, spring or warmer climate is happening where the bees are bringing in more than they're consuming. So they're giving, the weight gets a positive record or measurement rather than a negative where they're consuming. And so over the last 20 years, that warmer climate has been about a half a day early each year.
So I'm just going to play devil advocate for a second. What's wrong with more honey?
They're bringing in food for them because the queen bee is laying eggs and trying to build up the stock and the numbers and the population in the hive because the winter dwindles it down. But the problem is we get bloom source earlier, but then let's say we get bloom source by the end of March, but then we get a cold spell that kills off the bloom source and resets everything. That creates a problem because the bees need feed to feed the new young that are coming on, and their resources are dwindling down. They need it really early, but up maybe in New York or Michigan, it's colder. And if it warms up for a week or two, it kind of gives a false spring. Mm-hmm. So they get a surge of nectar, but then those plant sources might die off. But research is showing that climate is changing and getting warmer earlier in the end of winter than it used to be 20 years ago.
Right. And is there a way to help mitigate it?
From the bee standpoint, you can't. And from the plant standpoint, you can't. It's going to happen because of this cyclic change in weather that might be long-term and we have to basically adjust accordingly. So things that I need to know, or even a simple homeowner that wants to put a garden out, is you need to wait till the frost is completely gone to put certain plants out, like tomatoes. But from a beekeeper, I don't want to make splits and hope for warm days so new queens can go out and mate. And I don't have that, because I've got a 3-week window for a new queen to mate once she hatches. And if it's too cold, they're not going to fly and they're not going to mate. And so that hive will dwindle down. Then I have to go buy a queen somewhere and replace a queen. And it starts to become a problem in management. So,
yes. And is there also the issue of land use?
There is, where you have urban sprawl, where you're cutting into what used to be natural food source for wildlife and native pollinators. If you're destroying that, that becomes a problem as well. In the area where I live and where I've worked, there isn't that great surge of buying up farm grounds and making house lots out of them, or forest ground, because of the steepness of the mountains. It limits development in the area, but big cities tend to get bigger. Mm-hmm. But you know, there's some counteractive things. There's beekeepers, a beekeeping club in Washington, D.C., and they have their beehives on top of townhouses, and they have to shade them and cool them because it gets hot there. Trees are our main use for pollen in this area. Mm-hmm. And so springtime is when most trees bloom. That's our big surge of getting the bees really geared up and producing well.
Yeah. Now, you're talking about the honeybees, and right, there is also the wild bees. And Jonas Gledman from the University of Cambridge says he understands how the honeybees become a symbol of environmental conservation. However, honeybees were originally imported from Europe.
Correct.
And raised and managed by beekeepers in order to make honey or to pollinate crops. It's in a way, as he says, it's an agriculture animal in the same way that sheep or cattle are. And he adds that when flowers are abundant, there is plenty of pollen for both honeybees and their wild cousins. But in many landscape, or when an orchard stops blooming, farmed honeybees can compete with wild bees for food, making it harder for wild species to survive. Bottom line, he says that a healthy environment needs bees, but he says not honeybees. And I'm assuming that's, as an agriculture expert and a beekeeper, you may disagree.
Yeah, honeybees are an introduced species, but they were introduced about 400 years ago. Some documents lead to bringing them over on the Mayflower. Mm-hmm. They've been here long enough that they have become naturalized, because they become feral and they go out and live into trees like they did in Europe, in the Black Forest in Germany. Managed beehives are considered livestock by USDA. But the unmanaged or feral bees that are out in the woods and in the wild, in tree hollows, or sometimes even in abandoned houses or structures, they're feral and they're considered wild. There's a benefit for both, because different species of bees are, for example, a honeybee will go to certain crops. It doesn't always compete with flowering sources. In this area, we have lots of mountain laurel, which is part of, I think, the rhododendron family. Honeybees do not go to rhododendron, but bumblebees sure do. Honeybees cannot collect and eat and ingest the the nectar from rhododendron, because it's toxic to them. It's also toxic for humans to eat rhododendron honey. And so honeybees don't go to it. I have a buckeye tree that is on my property, and honeybees do not go to that. But the bumblebees and the wild native pollinators go to that. I plant a pollinator. I have about a half an acre of wildflowers for my pollinators. Mm-hmm. My honeybees aren't the number one species there. It's usually butterflies and mason bees and bumblebees that hit all that stuff. What's unique about honeybees and what makes them so excellent for agricultural pollination is when a scout gives the information to a bunch of workers, they go out and they will only go after that one flower source, let's say a dandelion or apple tree blossom. Mm-hmm. They will go from one apple tree to the next apple tree. That's what their pollination makes them so suitable for agriculture, because when the apple trees are in bloom, the honeybee will only go to the apple trees based on the scout giving them that information. They won't go to a dandelion and then go to an apple tree, because that doesn't cross-pollinate. The issue becomes when we deal with monocultures, mm-hmm. where you have the same thing hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of acres. For example, out in the Midwest, a lot of corn is produced. Corn doesn't produce nectar, but it produces pollen. Well, whether it's a honeybee or a native bee, they need both. They need carbohydrates and protein.
Right.
And so if it's a monoculture where you don't have anything else out there, it becomes a problem because it's either feast or famine.
Right. And then what do they do there?
If I would be out there working, what I would encourage is leave edges of the field for permanent wildlife pollinator strips, where you plant wildflowers that benefit the butterflies and the native bees, instead of farming right up to the edge of the field. Leave some corridors that could be wildflower mixtures that help counteract that monoculture environment.
With that, you kind of like, or at least that's my understanding, you're saying nature has its ways and nature finds its pollinators. So I still see that honeybees in a way are just maybe expediting the process, but it will still be another pollinator. So as much as I appreciate the bees, I'm thinking we're still pushing them in. We're interfering.
Yeah, we're interfering when we plow up the ground too.
That's true.
And when we graze off the ground too tight, and another species comes in. The natural ecosystem is always going to want to be pushing towards forest. Mm-hmm. If you leave something alone, it's going to go to forest unless it's a swamp or a wetland where it's limited based on the amount of water. And so as any country has been populated with people, they cut down the trees first, and then they try to, whether it's just somebody having a nice green yard or somebody farming to provide food for the population, we're always kind of interfering with that. One of the more recent in the last 5 years is, you know, leaving like these riparian corridors, whether it's trees or wildflowers, for nature and native species, so that you're taking a little bit, but you're counteracting with giving them some native ground that you're not spraying, you're not tilling up, and you're not grazing, so that those corridors can be really good places for wildlife of any species.
So bottom line, like everything else in life, is balance.
Correct.
And by the way, you mentioned a few types of bees. How many types of bees are they?
Some of the main subspecies of bees are the Italian bees, which are kind of the staple around the United States. That's what was brought over. But I'm sure you've heard of the Africanized bees, mm-hmm. that they still are producers of honey, and people actually manage those in the tropical areas, but they have their bad ill effects. But there's the Apis cerana, which is in India. It's half the size of a honeybee. Stinging problem isn't. They're stingless bees in South America. They're called bounce bees. They bounce off of the face of something that they would think a predator to annoy them and drive them away. So they don't always have to sting, but There's Russian bees that handle the, if you just think Siberia in a cold climate, they can winter over much easier. And so there's subspecies of just the honeybees that have been used throughout the world, so to speak, so that they can fit a climate and an ecosystem that is there.
Can we survive without bees?
I don't know what that answer is, Tally. If we lost all our honeybees, would the native bees be enough to sustain the food production? Because it's suggested that 80% of pollination in agriculture is done by honeybees, not native bees.
Right. And do you see a way to preserve and protect them?
Individuals can help both native and non-native, like honeybees. They can help them by whatever space they have available. They can plant things that produce bloom.
Actually, any of us can do that, right?
Yeah. If you live in an apartment and you have a window, you can put a window box out. And butterflies, insects, or whatever is going to be able to benefit from that. But they're not going to come to one window box in an apartment complex. They need to have every window to have something growing in there. So you can benefit by doing that. If they feed birds in the wintertime, they see bees coming early in the spring. I always get calls every year thinking there's bees wanting to build a nest in my bird feeder. And I said, they're not wanting to build a nest. They're kicking out the big kernels of seed to find the dust because that's protein. That's like pollen, like ground up corn or other seeds. They'll take that for protein and take it back to their hive because there's nothing in the environment that's producing any protein or flower source for them right now. So you can actually mix up a protein substitute just like you would feed birds in the wintertime. You can put food out for pollinators in the wintertime. So on warm days, they can go out and get protein.
What is the common myth about bees that you want to debunk?
The common myth is everybody thinks the queen is in charge, and she is not. Hmm. It's the workers, the females, that are in charge. If the queen isn't doing her job or something isn't quite right, they will stage a coup and replace her. Most people say, oh, she's the boss. Well, she's not. Her job is to lay eggs, but she does set out the pheromone to make that colony unique. Each colony has its own scent based on the queen. But the workers can decide that that queen is not efficient enough or we don't like her, and they will actually replace her. They will kill her and replace her. So it's the general, the common female, the worker in the hive that's in charge.
Interesting. So it's like democracy, a little bit brutal, but...
And to make it even worse, by November in the Northeast, the women all kick the males out and they die and starve to death because they eat too much. They're bigger bodied. They eat too much of the resources. So it's an efficiency thing. Queen will relay male eggs in the spring. And another little interesting fact, one of the very few species on the planet, the honeybee, the queen determines before she lays the egg whether it would be male or female.
Oh, wow. What did you wish you had known when you started?
Boy, if I would have known these mites would have come in and basically, it's called Varroa destructor because they destroy beehives. If I would have been able to know what was going on early on, and how to figure out. I use about three natural ways to counteract the mites and one that's a chemical way to kind of make sure that's how I've been working and using and managing my beehives to make it so my bees live through the winter. If I would have known that early on, so many beehives would not have died due to just that unknown fact. But again, it's understanding another pest in nature that was brought in and somehow came into the United States from out of the country that became a problem to the bees.
Sorry if I keep on going back to that, but a few researches that I found was actually talking about honeybees versus the wild bees, where they're saying that there's thousands of bee species and almost all of them live in the wild, and they're hiding away in the ground or odd cavities, like hollow plant stems and stuff like that. And they're in a way know how to survive. And once we provide the honeybee hives, we're actually damaging and not helping. So I'm just curious, what are your thoughts on that?
I just feel that there's two schools of thought. They're the anti-honeybee because they're not native.
Mm-hmm.
And so they can't be of any good. I don't like that theory because there would be nobody living on the North American continent, because we are all non-native.
That's an interesting comparison.
That person that is saying that is a non-native species to North America. Go back to Europe, where everything, the clusters came from, you know, Northern Africa and Europe, then they should, you know, they shouldn't be here. And so it's kind of like, if you follow that same mindset, then you're discluding yourself from, you shouldn't be here.
And so, right, but it's a little different when you talk about people versus you talking about species. You were just mentioning mites that were brought into the continent and destroying the bees. So
yeah, you've probably heard of the murder hornets.
Yes.
That are on the West Coast in Oregon and Washington State. It's pretty easy to bring a bug back on in luggage or something that you don't intend.
Mm-hmm.
But again, the key is the balance, knowing what the carrying capacity is in that ecosystem.
Mm-hmm.
Knowing that American agriculture, as we see it now, certain species really need honeybees to help production-wise. Example, it's an average, somebody that would raise raspberries and blackberries uniquely. If you have one hive per acre of fruit berries, you're going to double the production that is there. And so if you don't have a hive of bees there, the native pollinators are going to get it, but not as productive. And so Production agriculture is kind of one aspect, and backyard beekeepers, you could probably have one hive for every square mile, and it's not going to overpopulate. But when you have 20 beekeepers with 20 hives within 5 miles of each other, that's a carrying capacity higher than what's sustainable. And then you're competing with the native pollinators as well. So it's going to be location.
I see. So it's yes, as you said, location, balance, and we need to look at them as an agricultural animal. And that's a state of mind that I was not aware of. So Thank you. Can anyone become a beekeeper?
It's all going to depend on where you live. In the area where I live, anywhere in the county, anybody can have bees.
Is that complicated, dangerous?
I tell people honeybees are naturally vegetarians. They sting when they feel threatened. If you walk barefoot in a yard and you step on one, they're going to sting. Or if you go and swat one you're near a hive, they're going to react. But they pretty much can be left alone and not be a problem. The problem becomes when you don't provide the resources that they need, like water, fresh water, and they go to your neighbor's pool.
I see.
So there's best management practices for being a good beekeeper.
How can one start?
For 100 years, you could buy a package of bees. And a package of bees is a wooden box with two screen sides so they can breathe and get air. Mm-hmm. And you would get 3 pounds of bees and a new queen in a queen cage. And while they travel from point A to your place, point B, mm-hmm. that new queen's pheromone starts to spread amongst the workers that are in there. A 3 pound package would be about 11,000 to 12,000 bees plus one queen. And you would take them and put them in a box, and then they would expand to 60,000 bees come June. And then they reduce back down into winter to maybe 25 or 30,000 bees. And then they build back up when the population explodes when the blooms start happening. when it quits blooming in the fall of the year, when they have no more bloom, then the population starts dropping off.
So assuming this queen is okay and you treat them well, you have the kit one time and then this thing is regenerating itself. You don't need to do much.
It's sustainable, yes.
And one kit is enough?
When I teach my class, I ask people, how many beehives should a beekeeper have? The correct answer is only the amount that they can manage. Don't get five beehives when you can only manage one.
And how much work is to manage one?
In the spring of the year, it's a lot more work because you're checking to make sure that they're not going to swarm, that the queen's doing what she needs to do, and things are going well. So, but if you had one hive, you could spend an hour a week, and that's all you'd need to do.
What is your favorite tree?
That's all in context of what I want that tree to do. If I'm okay. A beekeeper, my most favorite honey is basswood or the linden tree. Gets heart-shaped leaves on it and really good nectar that produces extremely good quality honey. It's a lighter, yellowy-looking, yellow-colored honey, and it's probably the best honey source here. But if I wanted to plant a tree that the deer aren't going to eat and tear up, that might be, you know, I might plant a walnut tree or a sycamore tree. Kind of all depends on what I want that tree. If I want it for shade, that might be something, or color. And so that's a loaded question. What's my favorite? I have to determine what hat I'm wearing. And that probably comes because I had to sort through all that stuff with my working as a person that would recommend tree plantings for alongside of streams. I would say, what do you want those trees to do for you? Do you want them to produce nuts or fruit? Do you want them to produce flowers for wildlife? Or do you want them to eventually produce lumber for the next generation?
Well, thank you so much, Ben, for enlightening me and us on the values of bees and clearing out some of the controversies around them. I appreciate that.
Well, thanks for having me, Tally.
And thank you, everyone, for joining me today. We are all beautiful butterflies, each in his and her individual ways. I wanted to thank you for joining me today in this episode. I really appreciate you coming on this journey with me, and I hope you can join me next time. And remember, it only takes a small action to make a big difference. Be a butterfly.
And that's all for this episode. Thank you for joining us today. Please subscribe to hear more of our stories of change.